Welcome to Tales from the Library, a Sanctuaryverse book club. The Suspect by Jurek Becker. Believe me that I regard the security of the state as something that is worth protecting with almost all one's might. It is not cacophony and the hope that a certain government department might be more kindly disposed towards me that lies behind this confession. I just have a need to say it, even though I have been regarded for some time as someone who endangers the aforementioned security. That I should have gained such a reputation shocks and embarrasses me. As far as I know, I have not given the slightest cause to suspect anything whatsoever. Since my childhood, I have been a committed citizen. At least I have striven to be. I have no idea where and when I might have expressed an opinion that did not conform to that promoted by the state, and hence did not coincide with my own. If I did slip up, it could only have been due to a lack of concentration. The eye of the state, I hope, is experienced and sharp enough to recognise dangers as such, and overlook trifles that are anything but dangerous. And yet, something must have happened around me which provided sufficient reason to focus attention on me. Perhaps someone will understand me when I say, now I am glad that I do not know what it was. If I knew, I would probably try to efface the unfavourable impression and just make everything worse. As it is, I can go about my business in a carefree manner. At least, I'm getting there. In the meantime, it will have become clear that I'm being observed. My situation is complicated considerably by the fact that I regard such a procedure as useful in principle. Indeed, as essential. But in my case, as pointless. And, if I may speak freely, offensive. A man called Bogolin, whom I had regarded as loyal to the government until then, told me one day that I was being observed. Naturally, I broke off all contact with him immediately. I did not believe a word of what he said, me, under observation. I had almost put the whole matter well behind me when an extraordinary letter reached me. At first, it seemed that it was from an acquaintance from the neighbouring state with whom I had been good friends at school. It was an envelope of a type he had been using for years. It had his handwriting on it, and on the back, his name was printed. But the letter I took out of the envelope had nothing to do with him or me. It was addressed to a certain Oswald Schult, and signed by a certain Miss Trude Danzig. Two people of whose existence I had known nothing until that moment. I immediately remembered Bogolin's hint again. The letters must have got mixed up in the Bureau of Surveillance after they had been checked. To put it another way, I now had conclusive evidence that I was being watched. We all know that in moments of shock, we can be inclined to panic, and I did not behave any differently. I had hardly finished reading the letter when I grabbed the telephone book, found Oswald Schult's number, and rang him. When he answered, I asked him whether he knew Trudy Danzig. It was altogether a superfluous question after the letter. But I, in my panic, asked it. Mr. Schult replied, yes, he knew Miss Danzig well, and he had asked whether I had a message for her. I was about to explain to him what strange circumstances had brought us together, when it suddenly hit me how unbelievably foolish I was behaving. I put the receiver down and sat there in a state of despair. I said to myself, only far too late, that people whose letters are inspected probably have their telephones tapped. As far as the Bureau was concerned, one person under surveillance was now in contact with another. And to make things even worse, I had broken off the conversation before any reference had been made to the mixed-up letters. Of course, I could have rung Oswald Schult a second time and explained the matter to him. To the ears of those who were listening, it would have sounded like an attempt to wriggle out of it. And, more than that, in a way which could easily have been construed as defamatory towards the Bureau. And apart from all that, I was adverse to explaining anything to this Mr. Schult, who might well not be under surveillance without reason. For a long time, I kept quiet to avoid doing anything rash again. Then I made a plan. I said to myself that when you start in the wrong place, this creates its own logic. Then, suddenly, a logical consistency is generated, which must appear compelling to the person who has made the erroneous assumption. The suspicion under which I was held was just such a wrong starting point, and all my normal activities, which would have been harmless and without meaning at other times in the eyes of the Bureau, would only confirm and corroborate it. So, if I wished to dispel the suspicion, I just had to do and say nothing for long enough. and then it would have nothing to feed on and would have to be abandoned. I regarded myself as capable of passing this test, as I am someone who prefers to listen rather than speak, to stand rather than walk. And finally, I told myself that I should not delay my salvation, that it would not survive any deferment if I was serious about myself. First of all, I broke off with my girlfriend, who, in the eyes of the Bureau of Surveillance, might possibly be regarded as a bad girlfriend for me. It briefly went through my mind that she might be part of the surveillance staff. She had complete insight to all my affairs, but I found no basis for such an assumption, and so I left her without any such suspicion in mind. I do not claim that I did not care about the separation, but it was not a disaster. I seized the first available pretext, magnified it a little. 2 days later, there was nothing left in my flat that belonged to her. On the first evening after the separation, I was lonely. My dreams were not too good the first 2 nights. Then, the pain of the separation was overcome. In the office in which I was employed, I pretended there was something wrong with my vocal cords, which, as I claimed a few times in a croak, made talking painful. So no one noticed that I started to be silent. The conversations of colleagues gave me a wide berth, which soon became so natural that I no longer needed to resort to my problem with my vocal cords. It pleased me to see that in time, I was barely noticed at all. At lunchtime, I no longer went to the canteen. I brought sandwiches and something to drink and stayed at my desk. I made an effort to constantly look like someone who is thinking about something and who does not want to be disturbed in his deliberations. I also considered whether I should change from being a good employee to a sloppy one. I was of the opinion, however, that conscientious work, as I had always taken it for granted, could not possibly have given rise to suspicion, that sloppiness might rather be a reason for them not to take their eyes off me. So of all my habits, the only one that remained unchanged was that I performed my work punctually and precisely. I once overheard two colleagues talking about me while I was in the toilet. It was like the last flicker of interest in my affairs. One of them said he thought I must have worries. I had lost all my cheerfulness. The other one replied, "That happens if you lose your desire to be sociable every now and then." The first one said, "Perhaps they ought to look after me a little. Perhaps I was in a phase in my life where I needed a little encouragement." The first one finished the conversation with the question, "What's it got to do with us?" For which, I was heartily thankful. I had already made up my mind to have my telephone disconnected, but then I did not go through with it after all. It might have created the impression that I wished to eliminate a means of surveillance. However, I did not use the telephone anymore. I had nobody to ring, and if it rang, I did not pick up the receiver. After a few weeks, nobody rang my number anymore. I had smartly solved the telephone problem. For a short time, I asked myself whether it was suspicious that, as the owner of a telephone, I never rang anyone. I told myself that I had to decide between that and its opposite. I could not regard both as suspicious, otherwise I would only have one option left: to go mad. I changed my behaviour in all areas where I had found I had habits. And in order to do this, I studied myself with great patience. Some of the changes seemed to go too far, others made me feel silly. I implemented them nonetheless. Because I said to myself, how does one know how suspicion arises? I bought a grey suit, even though I like strong, bright colours. I was convinced that it was of minimal importance whether I liked something. Unless it was essential, I did not leave my flat anymore. I no longer paid the rent in advance, and no longer in cash directly to the owner of the house, but by postal order. All I wanted was a reminder, as I had never received one before. Sometimes I travelled to my work by tram. Sometimes I walked all the way. One morning, a schoolchild stopped me and asked the time. I showed him my watch, and from the next day onwards, I left it at home. To the point of exhaustion, I pondered the question of which parts of my behaviour were habit and which were coincidence. Often I could not decide, in which case I opted for habit. It would be mistaken to believe that I did not feel observed in my flat. On this point, I also thought, what did they know? I disposed of all books and journals that might cast a bad light on their owner. Initially, I was sure that there were no such publications in my possession. But then I was surprised to find what things had crept in. I occasionally switched on the radio and the television. Of course, only programs which I would never have listened to or seen in former times. As you can imagine, they did not appeal to me. And so, this problem too was solved. During the first week, I often stood behind the curtain for hours, watching the little that went on outside. But soon I had doubts, because someone who stands at the window for hours could be taken for a spy, or for someone waiting for a signal. I let the blind down, and put up with the fact that someone might think that I wanted to hide something, or myself. I led my life in the flat under artificial light, but I hardly needed light anymore. When I came home from the office, I ate a little, and then lay down and lost myself in thought, if I felt in the mood. If not, I dozed and slipped into a comfortable, gentle state which could hardly be distinguished from sleep. Then I rarely fell asleep until the alarm clock woke me in the morning, and so on. In those days, I was sometimes annoyed about my dreams. They were strangely wild and confused, and had nothing to do with my real life. They made me feel a little ashamed of myself, and I thought that it was a good thing that I could not be observed there as well. But then I thought, what did they know? I thought, how easily does the sleeping person utter a word which might be a revelation to the observer? In my position, I would have regarded it as reckless to rely on not being held to account for my dreams, should anyone find out about them. So I tried to rid myself of them, which I managed remarkably easily. I cannot say how this success was achieved. The silence and uneventfulness of my days contributed certainly as much as the resolve to shake them off. In any case, my sleep soon resembled a kind of death, and when the ringing woke me in the morning, I emerged from a black hole back into life. Sometimes I could not avoid having to exchange a few words with someone when I was shopping or in the office. To me, these words seemed superfluous, but I had to say them so as to not appear offensive. To the best of my ability, I behaved in such a way that no questions needed to be addressed to me. Nevertheless, if I was forced to speak, then my own words resounded in my ears, and my tongue balked at and struggled against the misuse. Soon I had got out of the habit of looking at people. I was spared many an unpleasant sight, and instead concentrated on things which were of real importance. One knows how easily a glance into the eyes of other people can be mistaken for an invitation into a conversation. This was now ruled out in my own case. I concentrated on my route. I concentrated on what I had to take hold of, or fend off. At home, I hardly needed my eyes. It seemed to me that I was moving with greater assurance. I hardly ever stumbled or made a wrong move. As a result of this experience, I hazard to suggest the downward glaze is the most natural. What is the use, I ask myself, of proudly raising your eyes if the consequence is constant slip-ups? I was also spared seeing how other people looked at me. Whether kindly, maliciously, compassionately, or with contempt, I did not need to take any notice of it anymore. I hardly knew who I was dealing with, which contributed greatly to my peace of mind. So a year went by. I had not set myself a time limit for this lifestyle, but now, after this rather long period of time, the wish was stirring within me that enough might soon be enough. I felt that I was standing at a crossroads, that my former ability to live for the day was being lost, bit by bit. If I wanted to, I said to myself, I could continue existing like this in future. If not, there would have to be an end to it now. At the same time, this longing which I was suddenly feeling for old times seemed childish or even illogical to me. And yet, it was quite strong. I thought it was likely that the suspicion which had fallen on me in the Bureau of Surveillance had evaporated in the meantime. There was no other sensible alternative. On Monday evening, I decided to go out. I was standing in my dark room and felt like neither sleeping nor dozing. I pulled the blind up, not just a little, but right to the top. Then I turned the light on. Then I took some money out of a drawer. I would like to mention that I had plenty of money, because I had been earning as normal throughout the year, but spent very little. So I put some money in my pocket without quite knowing what for. I thought a beer might not be a bad idea. When I stepped out into the road, my heart was beating as it had not done for a long time. Without having a fixed goal, I started walking. My old local did not exist anymore, that much I knew. I want you to go into the first pub which looked inviting. Probably it would be the first one I came to. I intended not to overdo things for the first evening, just to have a beer and look at a few people. Listen to them a bit. That should be enough for me. Actually, talking myself would have seemed premature. There would be opportunities for this in the future. Plenty of them. But when I came to the first pub, I could not bring myself to open the door. I felt childish, but nevertheless, I had to walk on. I was suddenly afraid that all the guests would turn their eyes on me as soon as I appeared in the door. After a few steps, I promised myself not to give in to such foolish fears again in front of the next pub. By sheer chance, I turned around and saw a man following me. That he was following me was, of course, only something I could assume at first. A few minutes later, however, I had confirmation, because I made the silliest detours without shaking him off. He always stayed at the same distance from me, even if I ran a little. It seemed to me that he did not care whether I noticed him or not. I do not want to claim that I felt threatened, but nevertheless, I was seized with terror. I thought, 1 year on, and it's not over. I'm still regarded as a security risk. How do I do it? Then I thought that the worst thing was that my behaviour did not matter at all. The suspicion had a life of its own. It had something to do with me, but I had nothing to do with it. That is what I was thinking while I was walking in front of the man. When I got home, I let the blind down again. I went to bed in order to consider my future. I already felt the resolve not to live for another year like this. I said to myself, surely the security of the state can only be maintained if those guarding it overdo it in some cases. Nothing else had happened in my own case, and still, nothing was happening. After all, it did no harm being observed. The last year had not been forced upon me, I thought. I did not need look for the guilty party. I had prescribed it for myself. Then I fell asleep impatiently. I woke up before the alarm rang and could hardly wait to look the first person who greeted me in the eye and say, good morning, no matter what might come of it. The Suspect by Jurek Becker.